from what we read in Ecclesiastes, that there's nothing new under the sun, that people still lie to us today. Religious folk, people in our own community, the media, and so forth. So believing a lie is an important thing that we cannot participate in, and all we need to do in order to not believe these lies is just to study. It's real simple. This is particularly sometimes considered a charged subject, but it's really not if you just read and understand and know the Bible and try to figure out what they're really talking about when you get presented these lies. So I'd like to turn first to 1 Kings 13:17, and we'll jump down to 1 Kings 13:24. And this is a good example of believing a lie. It says, "For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, thou shalt eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou comest. He said unto him, I am a prophet also, as thou art. And an angel spake unto me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with thee into thine house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him. So he went back with him and did eat bread in his house and drank water." Then we jump down to verse 24. "And when he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him, and his carcass was cast in the way, and the ass stood by it, and the lion also stood by the carcass." Now, in this example, this prophet, there are lies told to us today that have just as dire consequences as the lies that this prophet, young prophet, was told. It cost him his life. But the consequences concerning our lies that we believe really have to do with our soul and the things that we hear and the things that we understand and we believe today could have spiritual consequences just as bad as what happened to him. We could die and our soul can be taken to hell if we believe the lies. One such lie is alcohol. Like I said, that could be a charged example. And what I did was I found an article I printed from the internet, and it was originally written in 1989. And it was called What the Bible Really Says About Alcohol and About Wine. And the Worldwide Church of God put this together. I don't know who they are. I mean, I don't really follow anything like that. But this has been floating around since 89. You can pull it up on the web today if you just type in, what does the Bible really say about alcohol? And then one of these things will pop up. And if you're not discerning and you're one of those that's maybe new to this whole Christian life and repenting of your sins and trying to figure out what it all means, you may pull up an article like this from some religious group like this that says, well, it's on the internet, here it is. I think I'll just pay attention to what this says because they've got to be smart. It's on the web and this is a religious group, so let's see what happens. But that's not something we can do. We have to dig for ourselves. Tonight's going to be in the Old Testament examples. When I first did this like 8 years ago, it was like a three-parter and, you know, you get hundreds of pages of information that you can study, and it's just difficult for us as preachers and teachers to figure out what we want to include and what we can leave out. Because there's so much, we know the background of everything, of all these hundreds of pages of stuff we've studied, and it's just like, what do we leave out? So hopefully I haven't left out too much, but I'll try to keep it moving. The first lie that was in this article, and it says, the Hebrew word translated wine is yayin, which is true. This word is used over 130 times. It's really 141 to be exact in the Hebrew Bible, and it to mean fermented wine, not grape juice. They're very specific to say in bold print is fermented wine. So every time this word is presented itself in the Old Testament, that's what it means. And they're very clear to say it's not grape juice. So we know there are alcoholic wines. It's not a surprise. In fact, the authors of this point out that Noah drank yayin, which is wine, of course, and became drunk. So, therefore, it has to always be that. And did Lot and others, and we're not going to get into all that business because it's there. When the word wine is used, let's see, oh, I think I'm Well, my technology is not so good with this little clicker, so we'll see what it says. When the word wine is the same, the meaning is the same. Therefore, wine always means intoxicating wine. So that's their argument. Every single time you see that word used, it always means the same thing, and that's what they go by. And that's what the advocates say of this, of out drinking alcohol. Always intoxicating. It is not grape juice. And they do, let's see if I can find myself. Advocates say, but there is one kind of wine, for wine is defined in the dictionaries as fermented juice of the grape and intoxicating. So they turn to the dictionary, which is pretty much a logical thing when you're learning something new. So since they use dictionaries, I figured I'll use dictionaries also. However, I went to a little bit further back, to 1870s dictionary, and you look up wine. It says, juice, when newly expressed and before it has begun to ferment, is called must, and in common language, new wine. So there is a dictionary that tells us something a little bit different about the modern day one that this article is possibly using. So what do? You look at, let's go back to another dictionary, say 1750. It says under wine, it's called sweet wine, is that which has not yet fermented. How about we go back a little bit further to 1678, and it says wine, under wine, must. We heard that before in the 1800s. New wine, we heard that in the 1700s. And it says close, shut up, and not permitted to work. That means they squeeze the juice, they stick it in a bottle or a jar or a keg or whatever they put it in, and they shut it, and it does not get air, and it does not rot, ferment, or anything. And that's their definition of wine. So if we continue this, and we go to the 1880s, a little bit closer to us, Dictionary of the Bible, the wine was sometimes preserved in its unfermented state and drunk as must. So what I'm trying to get at here is with these dictionaries, it tells us there is another way. It's not just a blanket statement that says, this is it, every time you see the word in Hebrew, it's always the same. There are two different kinds of wine. And for some reason, the translators, it just always translated that way. No matter what they use the same word, wine. So let's not get thrown off by what it says. The term yayin in Hebrew scriptures is a generic in nature. It is, in its broadest meaning, designates grape juice. So it's more of, think of it more of as a generic term. Or the liquid which the fruit of the vine yields. This is new or old, sweet or sour, fermented or unfermented, intoxicating or unintoxicating. Only the context assigns the meaning. And this was written in 1848. So this Professor Stewart has got an open mind and a soft heart, because he says you have to look at the context. And that's what we're talking about today. How do we study these potential flaming subjects? Is we look at the context. And that will tell us, let the Bible be the commentary. And if you don't understand it, look at some old dictionaries where they weren't all tainted with what we have today, which is people putting out things that are ridiculous, which are lies. So if we look at the context and what is assigned in the context, then we can decipher what they're talking about. Is this a bad wine, yayin, or is this a good? And now let's check out lie number two. It said, to prove their point, it says, God also commanded that Levitical priests to include in their sacrifices a portion of yayin, or wine, as a drink offering. So they're going as far as to saying that the priests were ordered to give people alcohol, because it's always the same, and that proves it. So let's take a look at that. In Exodus 29:40, and with one lamb, a tenth deal of flour mingled with a fourth part of a hin of beaten oil and a fourth part of a hin of wine for a drink offering. So that's very specific. All this fourth part and all that, it's not there by accident. Now in Exodus 29:2, and the unleavened bread and the cakes, unleavened, tempered with oil, and the wafers, unleavened, anointed with oil, of wheaten flour shall thou make them. And 29, 23. And one loaf of bread, and one cake of oiled bread, and one wafer out of the basket of unleavened bread. What a surprise. That is before the Lord. So it's very strange that God would be very specific about leaven. Everything is unleavened this, unleavened that. It's in a basket. You take it out of the basket with the unleavened stuff. And then, as these people point out that the Levitical priests are supposed to do, that they require the bread to be unleavened, and then they would require or allow leavened grape juice, which is alcoholic wine, a product of decay, to be involved in the sacrifice. It just doesn't make any sense. So if you look at it as in that light, it's not consistent with what God would have us to do. So right there, it kind of cancels it out. You really can't have that. And why would they go through the process of making all this stuff when all they got to do is squeeze the grapes and offer it in the thing? Instead of, when you look up the laws of fermentation, as a little side note, there's three things that have to happen. You have to have sugar, you have to have yeast, which is ferment, and you have to have the right temperature. It's the same everywhere in the world, in every age. If you don't have these three things, and it's got to be between 50 and 75 to do that, to make wine. My father used to make wine. It had to be a certain place and a certain temperature. So why go through all that if you're just going to sacrifice to God? So it just doesn't make any sense. So we'll go on. Line number three. In special occasions, it tells us this. This is a good one. In special occasions, God even allowed use of what is translated strong drink. Now they're making the big gun here. This term comes from a different Hebrew word, shikar, which is used 23 times in the Old Testament and refers to alcoholic drinks made from dates and other fruit. So now they're pulling out the big guns. This is the big alcohol. Once again, it's basically a gross exaggeration of a definition. They're taking a simple definition and changing it. It is this. The real definition is shikar signifies a sweet drink expressed from fruits other than the grape and drunk in an unfermented or fermented state. So you can process it, or you can just squeeze the date juice or this juice or that juice that they had and make a drink out of it. And it's still called the same thing. It's generic in nature, and it doesn't always mean every 23 times that they're having strong drink. Now, once again, the English reader, of course, gets this from this translation, what they're propagating, the idea that's against the original Hebrew meaning. So we think of strong drink as hard liquor, basically, you know, distilled stuff, vodka, tequila, all that sort of, you know, strong drink. So what that type of distillation was basically unknown in the ancient world. It did not come into vogue until the Middle Ages. So that's what, 1,000 years, 4,000 years from the Old Testament stuff, when the priests were doing these things and they had strong drink, which is, if you take date juice, that's pretty sweet. You're going to take a sip of that, you're going to say, whoo, I need to mix that with some water. So anyways, it just wasn't possible. They didn't use that sort of strong alcohol. Now, yayin and shikar are therefore two generic terms, and they must be viewed in that light. We must view the context and the use of these terms and understand that there are two meanings. It can be fermented, or it can be just natural, wholesome juice of whatever they've just squeezed out of their fruits. The next statement is not really a biblical lie. It's just ignorant, is what I found. And it talks about, this is funny, it's right here in that article, the danger of these high alcoholic drinks. They're still talking about shikar, which is strong drink, being a high alcohol drink, is that unless one distills them or dilutes them, they rapidly lend themselves to abuse, drunkenness, and alcoholism. Now, all these religious groups will agree that you're not supposed to get drunk. So what you do with this strong drink is you're going to dilute it. So you're going to say this. Basically, what they're talking about is if you don't want to abuse it, you don't want to get drunk, and you don't want to have alcoholism, you take a shot, that's bad. Take that shot of tequila, you can't do that. You got to dilute it. You got to throw some margarita mix in there, and then you're fine, is what they're saying, which is absolutely preposterous to say that 1 ounce of alcohol with 6 ounces of margarita mix is going to change anything. It still leads to drunkenness, alcoholism, and abuse. But they seem to think that if you just put a little whatever mix in there, you'll be fine. That's the power that Satan has. He takes something so simple as just reading and trying to understand the context and then turns it into an entire whatever, a whole organization of lies. Now, liquors, flavored and sweetened, are somewhat different because they are usually served in small amounts and sipped slowly. So what this article is talking about here is cordials, like, Bailey's or some kind of Kahlua or something like that. Well, you won't get drunk and abuse those because you're going to sip them slowly. So anyways, it just turns ridiculous how the extent people will go to try to prove this point and to give basically new convents or converts or people that have been a Christian a long time that struggle with this a way out. And it's just not possible because the scriptures don't teach this. Lie number four. I got plenty of time. They told me there was a trap door and that I would be sucked into the other room if I talked over my allotted time. So that won't happen. This is my last point. Lie number four. It says the Hebrew word terosh, meaning new wine, is used 38 places in the Old Testament. People sometimes conclude that this word means grape juice, and they're going to prove that wrong, of course. Terosh is an intoxicating wine if used in excess. Another one. So everything in the Bible that's translated wine, no matter what the Hebrew word is, always means the same thing. It's either really strong or it's a little bit weaker, or you have to sip it slowly. It's just bouncing back and forth in a little box, and it can never escape because the lies are contained there. Why does he say this is an intoxicating wine across the board in our Old Testament? It's absolutely crazy. Everything is, according to these people who put this stuff out. His proof text is Genesis 27:28 and Hosea 4:11. So we'll take a look at these. In Genesis 27:28, it says, "Therefore God give thee the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine." So God is now giving us from the dew of heaven, fatness of the earth, all the stuff that grows from the dew of heaven, and plenty of corn, plenty of grain to eat. And then, by the way, you have to manufacture this business into alcohol because that's what he's giving you. That's what he's giving it for. It doesn't make any sense. The blessings were on the actual growth in the fields, the falling of the dew, the fruitfulness of the land. Otherwise, it's basically an arid desert area, but with the rains and the dew and so forth, basically Canaan was called in the Bible the fat land, which they were going to go into and inherit. Now, these are direct gift from God, all these blessings. In Deuteronomy 7:13, "And he will love thee and bless thee and multiply thee. He will also bless the fruit of thy womb and the fruit of thy land, thy corn and thy terosh, wine, and thine oil, the increase thy kine, and the flocks of the sheep, and in the land which ye swear unto thy fathers to give thee." The grouping of these is very direct and significant. It's everything, blessings. It's all these blessings upon this land that they're about to take. It's the womb, the land, which consists of corn, wine, and oil. Basically, your grain, your fruits. You know, what was that? They had grapes that were so big you carry them on poles, you know. I mean, that's what they're talking about moving into. And then the flocks would eat the grass. All these things are natural and wholesome. There is no divisive man or anything. Yet, we're told by groups of people that this Tirosh that they're talking about here is an intoxicating wine, something that is formed by the hand of man into an alcoholic beverage. So let me tell you about Tirosh in Kiddo's Cyclopedia. It's defined a vintage fruit. It means it comes out in a vintage. Tirosh is connected, this is interesting, contextually with corn, the fruit of the olive, and the orchard 19 times. It's not a mistake that it's paired with these things. With corn 11 times by itself, so the corn and the wine they're talking about. And then the vine, it's paired 3 times and then 5 otherwise. So 38 times total, this term is used, this Tirosh, and they say it's intoxicating every single time. It's manufactured into alcohol, and that's God's gift to man. 19 times with the fruit and your grain, 11 times alone, and so forth. It's ridiculous. Now, in Hosea 4:11, we read something else, but here just a few more things. 26 times it's translated wine. So basically, they're not very creative because I guess there isn't a word for that. So it always gets translated, no matter which of the three words in Hebrew that's used, it comes out like wine 26 times. And this particular one, Tirosh, 26, it's just plain wine. And 11 times it's new wine, and 1 time it's sweet wine. So when you're reading the context, you can get the idea. Yet we're told, like I said, it's always intoxicating. Now this one is a good one. This is one that Satan grabs a hold of, because he's going to throw us all off with this one, because now that we've got the idea that there's two different types of wine, there's the good, you know, grape juice, and then there's the intoxicating stuff, they're going to point to this in their article and say, well, wait a minute. It says here in Hosea 4:11, whoredom and wine and new wine take away the heart. And they say, well, grape juice could not have this effect. Grape juice cannot take away the heart. How do you answer that, you teetotalers? I'll tell you, there's three different things that are charged with taking away the heart. One is the whoredom. And it seems to be a little bit more symbolic in nature than, you know, specifically, you know, this is exactly what takes it away. This, we know that whoredom is commonly paired with idolatry. And number two, wine, they say, takes away the heart. It may represent drunkenness, or it may just be here, debased sensuality. We know that takes away, you know, having too much. You know, the guy that had the barns that he tore down and built new barns and stored all of his stuff. He just had a little too much, and it could be sensuality. And we have the new wine is also mentioned, and that could be luxury or overabundance. All these things take away the heart of God from God. We know this to be a fact. Idolatry, sensuality, and abundance and luxury. So certain interpreters imagine that only alcoholic drinks take away the heart. But we know from other passages in the Bible that pride, ambition, we've all heard that, worldly pleasures, fullness of bread take away the heart. So there are other things. It's not just one particular thing that takes away the heart. Especially in the New Testament, there's just the things that you think and the things that you say can take away your heart. The things that you worship. You're back to your idolatry again. Now, in Ezekiel 16:49, it says this, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. It was pride, fullness of bread, the abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters, neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy." So right there, we have three examples, or two mainly, of what we're talking about here. It is the fullness of bread and abundance of idleness. Now, God is the heart searcher. He searches our hearts. We know that from the New Testament. Here, specifies Sodom's sin, not merely her lusts, which we know about, he destroyed the city for that, but it's the secret of pride flowing from the fullness of bread. It talks about the fullness of bread. They had more than abundance. It was such a fertile place, that's where Lot wanted to go. Man, I'll bring all my cattle there, I can have everything I want. So it was very full of bread, had everything they needed. They don't need God after that. And then this caused the fertility of the soil, and it basically produced idleness because they got their crops in, they had enough to go the whole year, and they sat around thinking of other sensuality and so forth types of things. So you've now heard four lies produced by man in the Old Testament concerning alcoholic wine. Now, if you have believed these lies, then your soul basically could be in jeopardy, because I believed these lies. I was a new convert when I was 30. So for the next 10, 12 years, I looked up stuff like this and found articles like this and thought, well, there you go, I'm in. I can just continue doing what I want to do. You know, every once in a while I get drunk and that's, oh, well, it's a sin, I know, but I can repent of that. And people get caught up in this. But all you have to do is when you read these things, you understand that there is other things, not to believe these types of lies, then you can pull yourself out of these things and have a and make a stand with God and not against God. And Jeremiah 10:23, O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not with thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. So the idea of correcting, we can correct ourselves. We can take an honest look at what we do and what we read and what we understand. Take a look at the Bible, understand how they did things in the old days. Look older sources in these cases, tell us something different that they won't find in modern day things. And don't listen to man's wisdom concerning godly subjects. Anything can be understood. And God tells us that. It's not something for someone else to tell us. We can all understand it with just a little bit of study. And the good thing about that is if there's something we don't understand, and that is what drives us to understand it. And there's lots of these things that's hard to understand. It even tells us in the Bible, things are going to be hard to understand. But that gives us the responsibility to take control of ourselves and say, all right, I don't understand this, and I'm not going to believe the first thing I read because it agrees with what I like to do. It agrees with what I want to do. I still feel a little bit weird about this, okay? I'm still, you know, having my beer going, I don't know. I got my way out, but it just doesn't feel right. And then you need to dig a little deeper like I did. Once you read these things, and then you go into the New Testament and see how they use the same types of terms and all that business, you can make a judgment call that would be correct and more in line with God's laws. And they are laws. And we are responsible for following His laws and for doing what He wants us to do. Now, God's laws of pardon are also laws. And here they are. First, you have to hear. Then you have to believe that it is true, the things that you hear. Then you have to repent. That means turn away from your sins. Have an honest heart and say, you know, I've sinned, I've done things, I'm not going to do these things anymore, the things that you are aware of. And then you have to confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God. And then finally, you have to be baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins. That means everything that you've ever done from that point back is going to be washed away. All the hard things, all the horrible things you may have thought and done, and you're ashamed to even admit that you have done, all that stuff will come popping up. It's like taking a lie detector test. If you've ever taken one to get a job or something, they put this thing on you, they ask you one question, have you ever stolen anything? Suddenly you remember when you were 7 years old and you took a cap gun from Searstown. It pops into your head. You're like, wow, yes, I have stolen. You know, have you ever done this? And you're like, yes. You know, I took this lie detector test and I thought I was going to fail because I did everything that was wrong. This is what happens when you become a child of God and you are baptized into Christ. You start remembering these things that you suddenly have a flood of questions. How am I going to live this life? I know what I've done. He said, they say that I'm clean, but how do I do that? And then this is your answer. It says, Revelation 2:10, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. And that is our responsibility. All the people you see in this room, if you're going to be baptized into Christ, you are not alone. Every person in this room, they have the charge to take your new Christian life and to make it possible that you will be faithful unto death and you will have the crown of life. And that is our responsibility. So don't think because you've been baptized that you're going to say, we'll send in for a piece of paper and we'll tell you some more information. It's each and every one of our jobs to make sure that you do not stumble. And by doing that, as a new convert, we learn because we get all these old things that we've forgotten that you are going to be going through. As a new child of God, we remember what happened when we were new children of God. All that stuff comes up, and then we have the answer because we've had 5 years, 10 years, 40 years, 60 years of learning to understand. And then you remind us as a new convert what that's like. And we say, wow, you know, I feel so charged up helping this person. So don't ever think that you're going to be alone. And if you are a child of God, it doesn't make any difference how long you have been, and you have fallen away, it's the same process. Everybody here is here to help you, here to love you, and to help you back in the right relationship with God. And if you're hiding it, you don't have to hide it anymore. We have a song that we're going to sing that is going to encourage you to do something about whatever condition that you may be in. So if you'll get your songbooks out and stand and sing and come forward if you have any needs.